using that. And it's in the New Testament if you have your phone or looking it up. Mark chapter 12, we'll get there in a bit. And if you're a hands-on person, I know that during most weeks I'm either taking notes or I'm drawing on something. I like to listen, but I like to occupy my hands with something else so that I can just listen better. On the bulletin, there's not only sermon notes, but kind of a little space. If you wanted to draw, I would actually encourage you to draw a picture of yourself. You can draw your best self-portrait this morning if you like to engage in that way, and we'll use that in a little bit towards the end. But a bit about myself, I've lived here, you know, for about 10 or 11 years, but I'm a Pacific Northwest native from the Tacoma area of Washington, which means I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan. And just in case I got that response, I wore these. I wore these today, just in case, guiding me, helping me. Okay, so, I'm in enemy territory. I mean, I can't even catch a break here. And the Seahawks, I mean, got a Christian quarterback, and it's like, I would think the Cardinals, of all people, would love a team with a Christian quarterback. But apparently they don't, right? And we're division rivals, the Arizona Cardinals. I cannot, in good conscience, cheer for the Arizona Cardinals. Like, I can't cheer for them and mean it, right? I mean, like, any more than a Cardinal fan could cheer for the Seahawks and mean that. Even though we don't have Richard Sherman anymore, you still won't cheer for the Seahawks in good conscience, right? It would take really a special set of circumstances for me to cheer for the Cardinals or for you, a Cardinal fan, or whoever you're a fan of, to cheer genuinely for the Seahawks. And it was actually just a special set of circumstances. Now it's been like almost 10 years that I, a Seahawks fan, was genuinely cheering. I mean, I was really cheering for the Cardinals. And you can remember this if you're a Cardinal fan, February of 2009. I can remember where I was. I can remember the air that was in the room, and I can remember the air that got sucked out of the room in the last 2 minutes of the Super Bowl between the Cardinals and the Steelers. I was genuinely cheering for the Cardinals, not because they were the NFC West representative and the Seahawks in the NFC West, not for any of those reasons, not because I thought Kurt Warner was a great guy, although he is. The reason I was cheering for the Cardinals was because 3 years prior, the Seahawks were in the Super Bowl against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And in 2009, the Arizona Cardinals were in the Super Bowl against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And what had happened in 2006 was the Seahawks said we had maxed out our salary cap that year. But the Steelers hadn't. They had some cushion in their salary cap, so they were able to take all that money and give it to the refs so that they could win the Super Bowl. And we saw that. I was worried the same thing was going to happen in 2009. And sure enough, it did. You guys, we all saw it. It was just so obvious. So I was in that room cheering for the Cardinals to beat the Pittsburgh Steelers, and alas, we know how that ended. Well, then something even more special, unique, happened the following year. Not just Seattle cheering for the Cardinals, but the Cardinals and the Seattle fans cheering together for the Green Bay Packers. Why? Because next year, the Green Bay Packers played the Pittsburgh Steelers in the Super Bowl. And so there we were, united together, two enemies coming together to cheer against a common enemy. And I tell you that story because that's exactly the situation here in Mark chapter 12. You have some people that do not normally get along, as we'll explain, but they come together against this common enemy, okay? So if you're in Mark chapter 12, what you're going to read here is a true bipartisan effort on the behalf of the Jewish leadership to take care of this Jesus problem. So let's start reading in verse 13. And I'm going to read, normally every week we preach out of the ESV. This week I'm preaching out of a different translation called the Holman for the reason, because they're both accurate, but actually I think this is a little bit more helpful for our purposes this morning, and I'll explain that to you in a moment. But if you read and follow along, we're gonna read the exact same thing almost in any translation. Okay, so it goes like this in verse 13. Then they would be the elders, the chief priests, kind of the big shots of the Jewish leadership. Then they sent some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to him, to Jesus, to trap him by what he said. When they came, they said to him, "Teacher, we know you are truthful and defer to no one, for you don't show partiality, but teach truthfully the way of God. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay or should we not pay?" But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to him, "Why are you testing me? Bring me a denarius to look at." So they brought one. "Whose image and inscription is this?" he asked them. "Well, Caesar's," they said. Then Jesus told them, "Give back to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they were amazed at him. Give back to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God. I want you to imagine just in a moment that you're in the temple courtyard where Jesus was. This is a Tuesday before he goes to the cross, the last week of his earthly ministry. And I want you to imagine a big temple courtyard, maybe the size of this room or so, and Jesus is here with his disciples, and just about 50 to 60 yards away, maybe where the student building is, and this isn't in the text, but there's really not too many other explanations for how this happened. You can just imagine this room, and if you were to open the door to this room, you would be a little bit shocked because you would see all the big players in Jewish life. You would see the elders, the chief priests, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians. And these are people that normally wouldn't share a meal together, and yet you open up this door and you see them all in this room. And what you have going on here in this situation is basically the big guys, the elders and the chief priests, the top of the top, they've orchestrated these basically religious riddles. They've come up with these religious riddles with the intent to trap Jesus. And they're getting all these other guys as chess pieces together to go and try to execute. And so they try with the Pharisees, they try with the Herodians, they try with the Sadducees, they try and they keep asking him these questions. And it kind of looks like, you know, if you go to a water park and there's a water slide and you're the lifeguard, it looks like the lifeguard at the water park who's just saying, all right, go. All right, you're next, go. All right, go. All right, go. And they're just sending these guys out to try to get Jesus caught in these riddles. And after this, you're going to notice if you just keep reading, the Sadducees, they try. It's just like one after another. That's the way Mark presents it. They just keep coming, trying to catch Jesus, and that's the situation. The past 7 weeks, the reason we're talking about give back, the reason we're talking about stewardship, money, what the Bible has to say about that is because, in part, two things. The last, now, 8 weeks, about 70 of us, most of us from this church, members of this church, we've been getting together from 3 to 5 in the fellowship hall, just that big room down there, and we've been going through a financial biblical stewardship course called Financial Peace University. It's really ultimately about how do you handle, as a Christian, how do you handle God's money God's way? And it's real practical. It's got nuts and bolts of budgeting and paying off debt and what kind of insurance we need in today's age and what order should we accomplish these things. And then it also covers the big things with money, the fact that you and I are really just asset managers for something that the Lord has given us, that God owns everything, all the money in our possession, not just 10% of it, right? So it covers these small things and these big things. And all of our pastors are going through this, and so with that happening, and that conversation happening amongst us and amongst many of the people in our church, as well as just this understanding that, you know, we don't talk a lot about this, and if you look at our culture through missionary eyes, money is something that this community, on average, has more of than other places. And money is also a big stressor in our lives. And so we should obviously probably talk about what does God's word say, what's wisdom for us with our money. But today we're not talking about money. And in fact, if you think that God is mostly concerned about your money, our scope is way too narrow. About 4 years ago now, in the student building, it was a Wednesday night Bible study, and one of our students had been bringing a friend. And we had just finished a small group discussion, and this guest said, hey, David, can we talk after? I said, sure. So we hung back after everybody left, and they said, look, I've really been enjoying these, like, the last month. Like, it's been good. I've been getting to know some different people, but if I'm being honest, I haven't really grown closer to God during these 4 weeks, which is always really encouraging to hear, right, as the person who's teaching. I'm like, okay, well, and you're in my small group, okay? But I felt like there was something else there. There was like, he hadn't finished saying what he was going to say, so I was just quiet. And then he said these words. He said, my friend might have told you that I'm gay. And I've heard that that's a big problem with God. And I said, you know, let me lay those fears aside. I said, the problem, God's biggest problem with you is it's not homosexuality. There was a sigh of relief, like a visible sigh. You could see it on him. And then I said, actually, it's much worse than that. Didn't really help his situation, right? He and I began to meet for the next year to talk about what God's word has to say, not just about sexuality, but about our life, our heart, the place from which our sexuality, our self-centered living, our money, all these things emanate from. So if we're going to talk about money, which we'll get real practical next week, like you can download Excel onto your phone next week and use it. That's how practical we'll be. We'll talk about that next week, but if we don't talk about the bigger picture, then we're going to really have too limited a view of what God thinks about our life and the things of which are in our possession. And Jesus, in this passage, he's not talking about tithing. You might have heard this passage before, and people have used this to say, you know, give to God what's God's. God, it's the 10%, that's God's. The tithe belongs to God. You should give it to him. But Jesus is not talking about tithing or really money at all, although money is mentioned in this passage. He's talking about a much more all-encompassing view of our life, a perspective that he wants you and I to have, a worldview, something that shapes the way we see everything else. So let's explore this text a little bit together, and let's understand really how jam-packed and full this text is and what Jesus is really saying to us below the surface. So as we said before, there's these two people, these Herodians and these Pharisees, and it's like you can think of them like the Cardinals and the Seahawks fans. Like they have something in common. They're both football fans, right? They're both a part of Jewish life, but they don't really have a lot in common. The Herodians aren't really mentioned in Scripture a lot, so what we do know is that they have something to do with Herod. They're people who were associated with Herod, and Herod was the Jewish ruler of the people that was put in place by Rome. He wasn't Jewish, really. He was about as Jewish as fries are French, right? He was Jewish in name only. That was about all there was to this guy and to these people. But one thing we do know is they were pro-Roman government. They were all in support of the Roman government because that's whose payroll they were on. That's who put them in power, and that's who gave them power. And if Rome was gone, then so their power and authority was gone. They really liked Rome. And then you had the Pharisees, and the Pharisees were the exact opposite. They were anti-Rome. These people knew the word, they knew the law, they practiced it, they lived it out. They were very righteous people. And they had, for the most part, the loyalty of the Jewish people. But they were anti-Rome because Rome was over God's sovereign country. And they didn't like Rome. Rome was a foreign power like Babylon and Syria from the Old Testament. They didn't like Rome, and they wanted Rome gone. So why were these two groups together on the same page? Well, we see it has something to do with Jesus. And they asked Jesus this question. That's a really good question. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? Should we pay taxes or not? And they put Jesus in a lose-lose situation. Just think of it. If Jesus says, yes, it is lawful, okay, well, then he's going to have the favor of the Herodians. They're not going to have a problem with it. But the Pharisees can now say openly that this man is openly saying, teaching in the temple court, the most popular Galilean preacher is openly saying, Jewish people, you should pay taxes to Caesar. He's probably on their payroll. He is not a true Israelite. His loyalty is to Rome. And he's teaching you guys to be loyal to Rome as well. They're going to discredit him. But maybe even worse, if Jesus says, no, it is not lawful to pay taxes to Caesar, how long do you think it would take for Rome, the Roman Empire, who didn't get in power and stay in power through the process of peace, to come in and squash the most popular Galilean preacher who's now openly proclaiming disobey Rome? It's going to happen pretty quickly, isn't it? So either way, he answers, they don't really care. They got him. It's a lose-lose situation. And they're referring to a tax, and I want us to realize this is not an income tax like you and I pay, which you probably obviously don't like to pay, but we're kind of just used to the fact that we have to pay for taxes, and it goes to pay for our roads and libraries and schools and hospitals and, you know, like defense, things like that. So it's okay. Maybe we get back in some Social Security. The tax that they were paying, they were never going to see again. They would never see in defense, in infrastructure, in roads, in protection. Like, this tax didn't go to any of this. This was an annual poll tax. And what that meant was this tax was taken once a year, and it went directly to line the pockets of Caesar. It went directly to make the richest man alive even richer. So you can imagine how much you would enjoy every year taking a denarius, one day's wage, and giving it away to never see it again. It benefited you in no way. Not only that, you had to pay with a denarius. And here's a picture of a denarius. A denarius was representative of one day's wage. It's what if you were a soldier or a day laborer, you'd be given this for a day's worth of work. It was a silver coin, and it had on one side the picture of the current Caesar. So the denarius Jesus had or was given to him was likely a picture of Tiberius, the Caesar at the time, and it looked like this. And then if you were to see the other side, or even this side, you see all these inscriptions, these letters. Those are basically abbreviations for titles of Caesar, and they went something like this. They read, Divine Emperor, Father of His Country, Highest Priest, Consulship, Head of State. This denarius had a picture of Caesar with all of these titles on it, including the one about his divinity. Emperor worship was obviously a common part of Roman life. Caesar was believed to be divine from the gods and a god. And so if you were paying this tax every year, I want you to realize that it was a violation of your conscience. Because not only did you pay a tax you really disagreed with in terms of the purpose of it, but you also disagreed in the form of which you paid it. You paid it with a coin that had a picture of Caesar on it, and it claimed things about him that you knew were only true of God. Divine, highest priest, leader of his people. Like, this wasn't just a form of payment, this was propaganda. And I want you to imagine if you're a Christian who owns a business, and you are, at least in the past, right, before the Hobby Lobby case, you were had to provide health care for your employees, but that included providing health care services that you would have disagreed with, such as abortion. And it was a violation of your conscience, religiously and morally, to provide health care, to pay money out of your business and out of your pocket for something you disagreed with, like at the root of it. And this was the same situation that these Jewish people were in. It was a violation of their conscience. It wasn't just, I don't like paying income tax. It was the type of tax and the coin on which you paid it. All around, it just spelled false worship to these people. So this is a loaded question, isn't it? Is it lawful to pay this annual poll tax, Jesus, right? It's like, man, there is no way this guy is getting out of it. We've got the Sadducees in the back room, and they got a good question about the resurrection, but they're not going to even need to come out because there's no way he's going to get out of this question. That's what they're thinking, right? We went on a middle school mission trip just a few weeks ago. It was in Gallup, New Mexico, and we went to the Navajo Nation as part of it. And I realized this, but I didn't realize it until I was there when we went to Window Rock, the Washington, D.C. of Navajo Nation. The Navajo Nation is a country within a country. It's not just land, and I knew that. I knew it had special rules, but it's a sovereign nation. Like, you don't want to get in trouble in somebody else's country, and you don't want to get in trouble in Navajo Nation because they don't, like, my U.S. citizenship ain't going to help me a whole lot when I'm on somebody else's land, right? And one of the things we learned about, because the road got blocked by the police, they stopped us on the way to Window Rock because all these wild horses were crossing the road. And so we got stopped and we were just watching, I mean, like a pack of wild horses going. And one of the things that they told us was that on Navajo Nation, right, you can't do this at Salt River, but on Navajo Nation, if you catch a wild horse and you brand it, you are now the legal owner of that horse. You are the legal owner of a horse if you brand it. Now, nobody does that, but actually people are letting go their horses because they can't support them, so there's a ton of feral horses. But if you catch a wild horse and you brand it with your image now indicates that you own that horse. And we do this with our everyday life. Image, or ownership, is indicated by placing an image on it. You could look around, and in 15 seconds, you could find at least three things on your persons that have a logo on it. If not the tag of your shirt, your phone, your sleeve, okay, your shoes, the swoosh, whatever it is, those are logos, those are images that indicate who owned or owns who that clothing or item belongs to. That's what modern logos do. Modern logos are an extension of a company, an extension of a person. And just like a brand was an extension of somebody, it indicates ownership, where it came from and who it belongs to. So when Jesus asks this question in verse 16, whose image and inscription is this? He was asking a question of ownership. Who owns this coin? Because that's what the image indicated. Who owns this coin? When you guys get up from your seat, you know, you're eating, let's say you're back in the day, or if you're in high school, you get up from the lunch table, and you're coming back, and you come back, and somebody sat in your seat. And you say, hey, you're sitting in my seat. And then what does that person say? I didn't see your name written on it, right? Because our image, right, and in that sense, our name indicates that it belongs to us, right? And God has done the same thing. You've already gotten there in your mind before I even have. You're already thinking of Genesis 1, which we'll be studying in the upcoming weeks. Genesis 1, 26 and 27 says that God created man in his image. Male and female, he created them. That human beings were created with the image of God imprinted not just on them, but through and through in them. That God made us in his image. God has placed his image, his mark of ownership on us, on humans. Not on coins, not on shirts, not on horses, not on water bottles, not on your phone, but on people, on you and me. And so what Jesus is saying is, if you're just following his train of thought and what he's saying here behind the text, if we give back to God what bears his image, okay, we're not giving back a coin, we're giving back ourselves. If we give back to God what bears his image, we must give ourselves to him. We owe God ourselves because he owns us. The reason I chose this translation, and in verse In verse 17, I don't know what yours says. A lot of translations might say render to Caesar or give to Caesar. The reason I chose this translation is because it accurately gets, I think it's most helpful at the word that Mark, the gospel writer, uses here when he says, Jesus says, give back. Jesus didn't speak English. He didn't speak Greek, in which the Mark was written in. He spoke Aramaic. So Mark is translating Jesus' Aramaic word into a Greek word and trying to keep the full meaning of what Jesus is saying. When you and I use the word give back, or oftentimes talk about giving back, in this culture we talk about it at Christmas time or the holidays, and we talk about it like it's a good, it's like paying it forward, like give back to the community, like do a nice thing for somebody else, like pay it forward, right? But Jesus isn't talking about just this act of charity that we usually think of when we talk about give back. And Mark uses a word to get at that. So in Luke 4:20, I'll give you an example. Jesus is talking about a word that denotes original ownership. Okay, so when you give something back, it's owned by somebody else, and you're giving it back to them. And you're not only giving it back to this original owner, you're giving it back in like form, like in the same form it was given to you. And in Luke 4:20, the beginning of Jesus' ministry, you might have familiar with this story. This first thing Jesus does in his ministry is he walks in to the synagogue, and it's his turn to read from the scroll that day. And so he's handed the scroll of Isaiah. He opens Isaiah, he finds a place that's about him, reads a prophecy, messianic prophecy, and he says, today in your hearing, these words have been fulfilled. And then Luke 4:20 says, and then he gives back the scroll to the attendant, okay? Because the owner of the scroll is the attendant who gave it to Jesus, and Jesus is just giving it back to its original owner, and he doesn't give him a turtle dove or a rock or a piece of bread because he's giving it back to him in like form. The thing which he was given, he gives it right back to him in the same form. That's what this word means. When Jesus says, give back to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and give back to God the things that are God, he's saying, give back like it doesn't belong to you. That coin, you don't own that coin. Caesar owns that coin because his picture's on it. And the things that have God's image on it, you should give it back to God because God owns it. And you should give it back to him in the same form in which he gave it to you. Jesus is talking about something bigger, isn't he? He's not talking about money or what to do with 10% of money. He's talking about something much, much more than that. This means that you and I do not own anything. You and I do not own anything. There's not one thing that you can find that your image is on. Even if you made pottery in a high school pottery class and you put your little inscription on it, or like Milet and Woodshop, you made something and you wrote your name on it. You don't even own the wood. Right? Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Like, you can write your name on stuff, but it doesn't make it yours, right? The Lord owns it. You and I don't own anything. We actually then owe our whole self to God. That's what Jesus is saying when he says, give back to God the things that are God. We are to give back our life. We are to give back our life. There's not one piece of you and I that does not bear God's image. See, God didn't make man from the dust and then a couple days later say, oh yeah, I'm going to put my image on you. From the beginning, when we were knit together in our mother's womb, there is not one part of our body, physical or metaphysical, that does not bear the image of God. Your ability to think and create and reason and understand morality, all of this bears the image of God. It's why you're able and why I'm able to do the things I do is because it's God's image in me. It's why you're naturally drawn to something beyond yourself. Christian and non-Christian, naturally drawn to something transcendent, something beyond ourselves. Maybe some of you came to know the Lord because it was really just a search for something beyond just the physical. And you realized that there was something about God that drew you to him. There was, you know, back in the day we talked about there's this hole in your heart, you know, right? That's too cheesy, so I'm not going to use it, even though I did. But there's something that draws you to God. It's because he's placed his image in you. You feel it. Like, you know, there's some part of you that's not from you, and you're kind of naturally drawn to search for that. We owe God our entire life. And we owe God the big things and the small things. Before I came here, I was serving at a church in California, and every week on a Wednesday, I would pick up a group of boys, and this is a picture of them up on the screen, and I would pick them up in this car. This is my first car after graduating college. It was my first car ever that I actually owned, that I got to put my name on, and it was the Kia Rio Cinco. It was like the poor man's Toyota Matrix, you know, but I thought it was better than the Toyota Matrix, right? So I loved that car. I thought it was so awesome, right? Your first car. It's like nothing wrong with it. You know, I would get like a massage every time you turn the AC on because the whole car would shake, but I loved it. It was an awesome car. And I remember getting this car, and I was just out of Bible school, you know, Christian studies, going into ministry, and I was truly, as I still am, so thankful for it. And I remember just saying, like, I already said this about my life, God, I'll go wherever and I'll do whatever you want me to do. So when I got this car, I said, God, this is not my car, this is your car. Use it. I'm going into ministry. Use it for ministry. Like, I know that means a lot of things, more than I know, but, like, use it. It's yours. It's not mine. My name's on the title, but your name. It belongs to you. It's your car. And whenever you, just as a side, whenever you pray a prayer like that or you say something like that, it just, 6 months to a year, I think, it's like a spiritual law. 6 months to a year, God's going to say, hey, you remember you said that, like, I'm just going to remind you about that right now at this instance. So here we are, a year later, and I'm picking up these boys in that room. I'm picking up these boys to come to church every Wednesday. And the boy on the left there, picture there, Isaac. Isaac loved calling shotgun. Like, I think he liked going to church because it just gave him a chance to call shotgun. He was always the first to call shotgun, so he rode shotgun all the time. And Isaac loved to play with the automatic windows in the car. If you have kids, you know what that's like, right? It's just like up, down, up, down, up, down. And it's just like amazing the power you can yield with just two fingers to move this whole thing. And for, it's not even like, it's like less graphics than Atari, but it's still mesmerizing, right, for a kid. You just go up, down. So there's Isaac, like every week, up, down, up, down, up, down. And what had been happening slowly, I noticed one day when it came out of me, and I looked at Isaac and I said, Isaac, you're going to have to pay for that window once it breaks. And then I also had that thought, I'm like, I'm my dad now. I have become my dad. My dad said that to me, right? Isaac, you got to pay that, which is a total bluff because an 8-year-old has no money, and you can't hold him to that, but you're hoping they don't call you on their bluff. And sure enough, 6 months later, the motor goes down and then doesn't come back up. The motor had worn out like 6 months later. And obviously, Isaac wasn't going to have to pay for it. I was going to have to pay for it. When I went through that repair process and I spent about $140 on to get somebody to fix that, I realized what had happened slowly over time was although that car started off in my heart as God's car, over time I had brought that title back into my name. I had crossed off God's name on the title and put David's back on there. It was now my car to use for my purposes, and that meant don't mess with the window. Right? It wasn't some sort of like pious, like, I want to steward well the money the Lord has given me so we can't break things. No, it was like, don't mess with my car. Like, that's annoying, and you're going to break it, and I'm going to have to pay for it, you know? No thought to God anymore. It only took $140 for God's car to become my car again. All right, that's all it took. God wants all of us, and he wants us in the small things, and he wants it in the big things. He wants it in the small things like the automatic car motors. He wants to own, and he wants everything in my life, like my monthly budget and what I do with it. He wants my Sunday mornings, since we're talking about football, during the NFL season. Those belong to the Lord, not to me. Maybe even more so, he owns my Saturday mornings during college football season. He owns, this one is, he gave me, you know, this chance where I'm preaching this sermon, and I'm like, God, I want you to make this real to me, like, help me to convict me of it in some ways. And again, it's like, whenever you pray that, God will convict you. He will do what you ask. So then two days ago, God presents this opportunity, and I'm like, man, I don't want to give up my time. Like, I don't want to give up my self-centered living during this time. And God's just reminding me, like, this is my time. Like, that week is my week. It's not your week. So what are you going to do about it? Are you going to preach on Sunday and tell everybody else what to do, or are you going to do it yourself? So God is, even now, working in my life, working this text through and this Jesus' words to me. It means unplanned requests of my time, right, which is God's time. It means my 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. at night when I want to get home and I want to veg and I want to sit on the couch. I have a seat. I have a special spot. It's grooved. It's right. It just fits me perfectly. And I have a routine. I have a way I like to approach things, especially in the summer when I'm not teaching. But that's not my time. That's not David's family's time. It's the Lord's time to use for however he wants. Not for David to veg out and just check out, but for the Lord to use. There's 4 hours every night that God can use. God wants to use, and he wants me to give it to him. But it's also the big things in our life that belong to the Lord and that we need to give to him. It's our future dreams and our hopes, you know, the things that you daydream about. Like, are those your daydreams or are those God's dreams? Are those the things you're thinking about? What would the Lord do with this? We take, it's interesting to me, and I'm just thinking about this because I'm guilty of it. We take a third of our life, a third of our living years, and even if we say these first two-thirds are the Lord's years, we take a third of our life and we dedicate it to ourselves in retirement, or at least we can, right? We can take a third of our life and say, now that I've worked hard, I'm going to spend these last third how I want to. But those, our retirement, even our retirement, even if you're far away from it, those belong to the Lord. If you're a student and you're thinking about college, I would challenge you and ask you, just I'm not saying God's going to write down and tell you where to go to school. But, like, do you consider God in your future planning? Are you asking God, like, what do you want with my life? Or have you already made that decision for him? If you've got a home, like, that is not my home, even if you own it outright. Like, the Lord, it belongs to the Lord. I made my brother-in-law, my sister, they never let me forget it. I made them eat toasted garlic bread over my kitchen sink years ago. I've gotten much better. Years ago, because I was like, I just cleaned this house. I'm like, you have to eat that bread over the kitchen sink because you're going to get, that thing's just like burst forth with crumbs. I'm like, you got to eat it over the sink, right? Now I've gotten better. That's what marriage and a child will do for you, right? It's like I got, you know, my cleaning my baby's diapers on my hands. I'm like, this is much worse than crumbs. I guess I'm okay. But nonetheless, right? Like, I used to have set up this tight control over even my own house, which I was ironically so thankful for God for when I could even realize I could afford a house. I'm like, God, this is your house. Use it however you want. Don't eat the French bread unless you're over the sink, right? Even our homes. If you have a second home, it is not my vacation home. It is the Lord's home. One of the best blessings in my life was last year when I was on a sabbatical, which you guys gave me and I was so thankful for. And there's a couple in Texas, and they spent all their own money. And what they did was they renovated this, like, 800-square-foot box of a house. And they renovated it and set it up so that pastors and ministers and missionaries could, for free, stay there for as long as they wanted to. And it was just out in the middle of nowhere, Orlando, Texas. Just nothing going on. There's Cooper's Barbecue, and that's about it, right? It was so peaceful. And there was no internet. It was a record player and a slow pour-over coffee. It was just so that people could slow down and hear from the Lord, and it cost me $0. And ever since that, my dream has been, if I am able to afford a second home, not to use it for myself in the hot summers or to go up and escape all the time, but I want to bless somebody the way this has blessed me, because this is remarkable. Sure enough, no doubt that will come back to, it's going to be the French bread all over again, right? It's going to be the car all over again. But I was so changed by that experience and those people's generosity. If you have a second home, it's not your vacation home. It's for the Lord to use to bless other people. My children, like Levi, my 11th-month-old, like, we joke and say, you know, what sport is he going to play? I'm like, he's going to be a wrestler. He's going to be a water polo player. I've already got it decided. I already know what he's going to, like, oh, he's going to be a football player. He's going to be a defensive lineman. We pick our kids, like, future for them, when they can't even walk, right? But he belongs to the Lord. Like, we have to give him over and over and over again to the Lord. Like, his future, his hopes are not my dreams and my futures lived out in him. Our children belong to the Lord, for them to go and do whatever God wants, even if that means going to a very dangerous country to tell people about Jesus. And even if that means not growing up and doing the profession you want them to or going to the college you want them to, like, our children belong to the Lord. We need to give them over to that. Our sexuality, since we talked about it at the beginning, belongs to the Lord. Our body is the Lord's temple if you're a Christian. So I cannot do with my body whatever I feel like doing. Like, it belongs to God for me to do what he wants me to do with it. And that means then if I've got a romantic relationship, if I'm dating or certainly married or not married, like, my body and my romantic relationship belongs to the Lord to honor him, not to make myself happy and to please me. It's these small things in life that come out. But those really aren't, they're just pointing to the big things, aren't they? These little instances, the French bread over the kitchen sink is pointing to something much bigger, and that's that I've laid claim to a home that I used to be grateful for and gave to God, and now I've transferred ownership back in my name. You drew a picture of yourself, maybe, on your paper, and even if you didn't, I just want you to think about that in your own life. Like, is there a part of you, part of your life, tangible or intangible, that you have erased God's name? You've put a keep out or a no trespassing sign on it. You've said, God, I serve you in all these ways, so I deserve this one place. Or I give him myself, and I give him my time all these times, so this time is my time now. Okay, I'll give you all these times, but this time is for me. This time is me. And I'm not saying in a way of, like, self-care. I'm saying in a way of, you've told God hands off, like I have, which I didn't realize until it was obvious. Where have you said hands off to God? As our worship team is going to come up and play a response song, it's a song that's called Take My Life. You might have seen it. I don't know, I couldn't think of a more appropriate song for us to collectively sing, knowing that we believe things, and in our heart we want them to be true, but they're not always true. It's kind of like with Jesus, you know, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. The Father's cry, Lord, I want this, but help me to want it. We may want it, we may not want it. I want to remind us just of one time one instance in the Bible where this is an exception, where God does not give back, where we're not commanded to give back, and where God doesn't give back, and that's in the gospel. The gospel is the exception to this give back principle that we see. The gospel is not a theme of the Bible, it's the Bible. And the reason why the Bible is so big and it can take you so long to read is because the gospel is so rich and so profound that you and I, it takes us, we never get to the end of understanding the depths and the riches of Christ's love for us and all that it means and how far it can seep into our life. And in the gospel, the pattern of giving back in like form that which was given to you is broken, because what you and I deserve is for God to give us back the equal and just consequence, good or bad, for our life. And because we're sinners, God ought to give us back eternity apart from Him, eternity in hell. That's what we deserve. That would be God giving back in like form that which we gave to Him. We broke His law, He would give us a penalty for that. But in the gospel, what God did through Christ was, instead of giving us back God's wrath poured out on us, He gave that to Jesus. And instead of giving back to Jesus what He deserved, an inheritance, fellowship, unconditional love, in a moment later that week on the cross, He gave that forever to us so that you and I could be called a son or a daughter of God, that we can have an inheritance in Christ far beyond any inheritance you're going to get from your parents. Christ has secured for us an inheritance. He has made an exception for you. And I don't know where anybody is at in this room. I know where some people are at, people I'm in community with, but I don't know if you're a believer, a number of us are, or not a believer. But there's two things for us to think about here as we sing this song. One, where have I sold God? You can come this far, but you can come no more. This is hands off. I've given you this, but I'm keeping this for myself. Where is that in your life? Ask God during this song to provide an opportunity soon to help you break release, break control, loosen your grip over that thing, that person, that tangible or intangible. And then secondly, just to meditate, if you know the Lord, and if you don't, to think seriously about it, on the exception that is the gospel. That instead of getting back in like form what I deserve, I've gotten back what Christ deserved. And He has placed on Him the sin of us all. He made Him who knew no sin to become sin so that we might become the righteousness of God. This is what Paul is describing in Corinthians. So I'm going to invite us, let's stand and let's sing this song. This song we mean it, it's a prayer, it's a declaration, but it is also, God, I believe it, help me to believe it. I know it's true, but I want it to be even true in my life.
Yeah. It's good, good word this morning. Thank you, David. And if you've wondered about, how can I do ministry? Maybe there's some time that you're convicted about now and you say, I can use that. Well, let me invite you to be part of this, Mercy Hill Vacation Bible School. Mercy Hill is one of the church plants that, as a church family, we support. We get behind them financially, emotionally, spiritually, and they are downtown on Fillmore, and they're going to do their first ever VBS this week, and we're going to help them. Several folks have already signed up to go. We got a team that's going tonight to load out some equipment and some things to take it down there and get it set up. And then each evening this week, Monday through Friday evening, we're going to be helping them do VBS. We're going to join hands with them. And so you can pray for that, but maybe you'd like to go and be part of it. And if that's true, you can tell somebody at guest services, take that step and say, hey, I'm interested in helping at Mercy Hill. How do I do it? Who do I talk to? And they'll get you in touch with the person that you need to do so that we can truly, as we leave here, go be the church out there. God bless you.